Successful people learn how to make their mind work for them. I'm David Nagel, and this is the Successful Mind Podcast. Hey, everyone, it's David Nagel. Welcome to the Successful Mind Podcast. Me and BT are in the studio today, and we've got some listener questions that we're going to devote this episode to answering. So what do we got there, T?
Yes, we do. So I'm always excited about these Ask David sort of segments that we're doing. So we're starting to get more and more questions. So people are listening to you, David, at the end of every episode or the beginning of every episode saying, remember, if you've got questions, reach out to us at tsm@davidnagel.com or send us a voicemail at speakpipe.com/davidnagel. People are taking notice, and we greatly appreciate that. So thank you so much for that. So yes, I've got several questions we're going to rip through today. Okay. And I will start with one from Irina. So Irina asks, how do you integrate the ego for greater success in life? And what are the beliefs that people have to let go of if they wish to do this in order to make a greater impact for themselves and for impacting the world through their work?
Well, that could be a class right there. I think the idea is about, this is really about self-awareness, right? So we could sit around and pick our ego apart to death. And, you know, if we just come from the simplistic idea that the ego is basically, well, I mean, a lot of people say, well, it's the false self, but really it's the belief system and the self-identification that we have constructed to navigate our way through the world. So it's not necessarily a bad thing because it moves us from place to place, from goal to goal, from, you know, how we're actually living our life. And when people are looking to kind of deconstruct what they believe in the world and see how do those beliefs match up based on where they think that they want to go, the goals that they want to achieve, the aspirations that they have, challenges that they want to take on in the world, even down to if people sit around and think about how do I want to be, who do I want to show up as in the world from a moral or an ethical or a value-based perspective, they're also looking at the beliefs that they have that they've been given and they've adopted since they were children about basically everything that's out there. And do those line up? Is that something that is about, you know, that they line up in a way where they're productive and heading in the direction of the way that they want to build their life? And as we start to find beliefs that don't add up or we don't like, that are part of this ego construction that we have, or even how we see ourselves, what we believe about ourselves, opinions and ideas that we have about different topics in life, society, the world. When we find something that is easier, like it's interesting because a lot of times we'll actually find a belief that we have that's not based in any truth whatsoever. It's something that somebody made up out of fear or prejudice or even could be magical thinking in a way, and it actually has no basis in truth, but a person or several generations of people may have been following that kind of an idea. An interesting one would be luck, because luck is one that's out there that's been out for a long period of time, and I don't think that there's any basis in truth for luck. Luck is pretty much the way that we describe an event that takes place where we do not understand the cause and effect of how that actually happened. So then we'll throw the term, you know, luck at it. And what's interesting is that a lot of people actually really believe in luck. So there's many things in our life that we can find that don't necessarily have a basis in truth or don't necessarily line up with the direction of who we want to be in the world. So then what we're doing is we're evaluating. We're evaluating like, okay, so here's something that's not working for me. Maybe we came upon it by we're suffering the experience of a negative result in our life for a period of time, not understanding what's causing the negative result, getting frustrated with it, sitting down, either studying some material or talking to someone or just really trying to think through the problem about what's causing it. We isolate a belief, a set of pattern behavior, a way of seeing that problem in the world, and we find out that we're causing it. So we become intimately connected with the idea of the way that I'm thinking, the way that I'm feeling, the way that I'm acting is causing this problem. And we determine, we get very clear on determining a new result that we want. So then when we do that, we're looking at, okay, so who do I need to be? What do I need to believe? How do I need to act? Who do I need to show up as in order to get this new result? And then we let go of the one that's attached to the ego. And I think that people that are really focused on self-development, always making themselves better, bettering their best on a consistent basis, they're always looking at these things throughout their lifetime. So this is not like something, oh, I did this for a year and I got rid of all my negative beliefs and I totally deconstructed my ego and rebuilt myself. I don't think that that really happens. I think people can make like a quantum leap in change in a year. But I think that this really happens over a period of a lifetime, because as we move through our life and we get older and we get more mature around things and we have more life experience, it's not uncommon for a person to change their belief around things several times based on the experiences that they have through life or and the increased experiences that they have through life. So, again, I wouldn't be too focused on the idea of I need to get my ego out of the way. What I think we need to do is to become aware of what it is, how it's operating, and really do a critical analysis of what are the beliefs that I have and why do I believe them? Did I take those beliefs on because I made a practice of critical thinking around the topic? And then I studied and I evaluated and determined what I want to believe about it? Or did I just accept it blindly from somebody else or through maybe even the hardship of experience? You know, so I think that's really what we have to do.
Well, that's great. And Irina also continues with a couple more. So there's like two parts to this as well. She says, is there a dividing line where the higher self just doesn't answer to ego? Or can the ego really ever not exist in order to have this big impact?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. Because the, you know, here's the thing. We can unlearn ways of thinking. We can unlearn patterned emotional responses. We can unlearn patterned behavior. It still lies, those beliefs, those reactions still lie dormant inside of us. And you could go through life thinking that you'll never react this way again, the ego will never get in the way again. And then guess what? Something happens in your life that is completely unexpected and you react poorly to it, or you react from the ego mind that you did 20 years ago. It's holding a higher belief system for yourself is a consistent practice that a person has to do, because we have to remember this: when we're changing beliefs that are like the construct of our ego, we're changing them. Like there's already a belief there and we're changing it to something different. It's not like there's nothing there. So when you have a little child and you're raising that little child from an infant, there's nothing there. And you're giving that child, you're showing that child how to interpret meaning for everything in their life. And then that becomes the foundation of how they think. And that becomes the foundation of how they view their world. But when a child grows up and they start wanting to make choices for themselves and replace that, they're literally replacing it. So it's kind of like they're remapping over old territory, but the old territory is still underneath that new pavement, so to speak, right? And it can creep up. I don't even think it's productive to think to ourselves, can we get to a place where we'll never do this again? Because it almost kind of indicates like we'll never make a mistake. And the truth is that we need to make mistakes so that we can learn. So if the perfection is the idea of what she's looking at here, we should get that out of the way and just focus on being human and doing the best that we can and removing any shame and guilt from mistakes that we do make.
That's great. Perfect answer. Irina was very busy, so that was part one of her first question she submitted. She submitted a second one a short time after that, sort of changing gears a little bit with this one. So she asks, how does false desire show up in us and in business? Can you define strategies to make a false desire more apparent or become a true desire?
A false desire is not that difficult to understand if you just ask yourself a couple of questions. I think one of them would be, why do you want to be, do, or have that? And then you have to be brutally honest with yourself. Is it part of, well, let's put it like this. So I think that a person should spend a significant amount of time really seriously thinking about what they want to do with their life whenever they wake up to that idea. A lot of people don't wake up to that idea till they're in midlife. That, like, they don't really actually sit down and think to themselves, I can do anything I want. I have the power to choose. And if I work on myself and I work on certain skill sets, I could create whatever it is that I truly desire to create. What is that that I desire? And really start to work through those things. But then questions come up like, is this something I really want? Or is this something that I want because my mom and dad said that I should do it? Or a teacher told me that I should do it? Or they said that I had an aptitude to do some specific thing in life. And did I just take that belief on blindly? Or am I really looking at what I desire? Now, very often, a person will have a desire for outside things, and we'll call that materialism or materialistic, and we automatically make it wrong. I think that if a person is consciously paying attention to what it is that they desire, it's always leading them back to the truth about themselves if they stay conscious with it. Like, the new car is not going to solve the problems and make you totally fulfilled. You might be happy driving the new car, but it's not really going to generally change your life. But the process in actually getting the new car might, because we have to overcome obstacles, we have to learn things, we have to discipline ourselves to do specific things. So in the process of going after certain things in the material world, we start to build ourselves up as far as what we can do and actually follow through and trust ourselves and become our word, that type of thing. So I think that we have to really look at what is it that we really desire. And false desires usually come from, I need this because I'm envious of someone else, or I'm worried about what somebody else is going to think, or I'm jealous of someone, or I'm seeking some kind of approval. Or I think that by having certain things in my life, it's going to make me okay. Like, if I don't feel like I'm okay, that, like, there's something wrong with me, that if I have the new car and the house and the shoes and the perfect relationship, that that's going to make me okay. So if we're coming from places like that, then yeah, they're desires that are masked in some kind of healing work that we should be doing for ourselves. But as we start to, you know, you have to work through those things. I mean, it's not like you just make them go away. You don't know what they are until you actually start to really seriously look at it and ask proper questions about, why do I want it? And then you have to be radically honest with yourself.
Yeah, and don't you think a lot of people are maybe afraid or hesitate to make that step because they fear that it's going to be the wrong. Like, you hear this a lot, even at our events, people will say, well, I want to do this thing. It's where my purpose lies, but I'm going to keep my 9 to 5 because I don't want to be wrong. Is that sort of where that comes from?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. They're afraid to make a mistake. I listened to a lecture by Jordan Peterson where, and I'm roughly quoting this, I don't know if I have 100% accurate. He's something about who are we to dare say that we believe in God? And I was listening to him, and the reason that he was saying this was because people say they believe in God, but they act like there is no God, that everything is just a matter of chance and luck, and you know, the world is going to fall apart at any second. And if we really believe in what it is that we're going to do, we're going to step out with the principles in order to make that happen. The principles are there, whether you look in religion or you look in spirituality or you look in universal laws or you look in scientific analysis or psychology. They're all the principles to do whatever we want to be, do, or have in life are there if we're willing to do that. But when we just say we want to be something and then we don't go do anything, or we say we want to have this career or live that dream, but we're not willing to let go of anything or seriously work up to the point where we can walk away from a job to be able to do it, then we're just lying to ourselves. You know, it's kind of like we're saying something to make ourselves feel better in the moment, like we're actually doing something, but we're really not.
Right. Yeah, I love this question because I resonate so much with this, because the reason I went into my first profession was because of safety and security. It was, you know, I was a school teacher for 11 years. When I was in college, I went there not really knowing what I wanted to do, like most 18-year-olds don't. I got there and I'd grown up in an environment where, you know, you go to college, you get a degree, you go to work and you get your benefits and all those sorts of things. It was the safety and security in an article that I read that said, you know, males are going to be so sought after in the elementary education field. So that's immediately where I went. Even though I didn't necessarily want to, I did because of safety and security. So if I go back and look, and teaching was very good to me, that isn't to say that the teachers aren't doing an amazing job, but I went into it not because it was my true desire, but because I was seeking approval from my parents, seeking approval from my family, those who had, you know, wanted me to go on to college and become this thing. It's really interesting going back and looking at that, because I'm typically a risk averse person. In my relationship, it's my wife who is the risk taker. But knowing that, I just love the concept of the false desire versus the self desire or the true desire, and the questions you should ask yourself when gauging that. I think that's freaking fantastic.
Yeah, that's good.
I love that. So, okay, so I've got another question here from Ramir. And Ramir writes, first of all, I've been a fan since I first ran across your work, which I discovered through my brother for almost 3 years now. Currently, I'm working as a firefighter in my hometown, and I have aspirations in being an entrepreneur. However, I haven't necessarily discovered my niche. My question is this: do I continue to stay focused on my career and allow this path that I've been on to lead me to discovering what I'm capable of? Or do I switch gears and work on getting in an environment to be more of a motivating force?
I think you got to change your environment. Firefighting is a great, noble career, but it's also a trap. People go into that career and they stay there for the rest of their lives. It's safe. It's, not safe from the aspect of what you're doing for a living, but it's safe from the idea that you've got a job and then it pays and it has, you know, they generally have good benefits. But those kinds of jobs are dream killers for a lot of people. Now, some people are meant to do that. That's totally different. So if you're a firefighter and you're meant to do that, that's extraordinarily honorable. But if a person went into that field because they wanted safety or security, or their parents did it, or their father and their grandfather and his father before him, that type of thing, and you really want to go do something else, then you need to go work in an entrepreneurial type of an environment so that you could really learn and see if that's exactly what it is that you want to do. You're not going to, you're just going to stay in a dream in your head if you stay as a firefighter.
That's great. Yeah. Environment's so huge. Just being able to change things up. And again, you know, putting yourself out there and following your true north or whatever it is that's guiding you that way. I think that's really cool. Well, thanks. Thanks for that question, Ramir. All right. Let's wrap up with this one here. And this is something that you've talked about in many of your events, and it's around the core wound model. So this came from Adam, and we know Adam. We've seen him at our events. He said, well, first of all, I enjoyed meeting you and the crew at the Art of Success meeting recently. I was so fired up during those few days together. And I'm looking back at my notes and remember David talking about the core wound model, or the core wound diagram as we know it, and how it starts as a child, which is heavily influenced by shame and guilt that shapes our secrets and so on. He remembers listening to you and understanding it better when you were talking about it, but as he read through his notes, it just kind of was drawing a blank. So he's looking for understanding around what the core wound model or diagram is. And we've done podcasts on core wounds and things like that, but maybe you could shed a little light for Adam around what that core wound diagram stands for.
Well, yeah, so this is a great question. And it does take some thinking to go through it. So I'll try to do this justice in the few minutes that we've got left here. But the idea is basically this, that through the repetition of dysfunctional behavior, so to speak, that we're exposed to, we start to develop the belief that we're not lovable, we're not worthy, we're not good enough. It's basically we're not enough of something. And then, so that lays this foundation of kind of like who we are and how we show up in the world and what we believe we're going to get or not get. It's reinforced by the idea of shame and guilt. So that means that if you're heavily influenced in your life by a doctrine of shame and guilt for everything that you do, because some people literally go through their life and their parents and their religion and their teaching environment or whatever, their learning environment as a child, they're constantly shamed for what they've done wrong instead of somebody not making them part of the problem, but literally showing them how to get a different result. Now, when that happens over and over and over again, the person starts to internalize that there's something wrong with them. And look, I mean, here's the truth. That could be true. Like, a person could find out there's something seriously wrong with me in the way that I think, the way that I behave, the way that I show up in the world, whatever. But it's coming from these types of beliefs that happened in our childhood and the way that we internalize them. So that requires that we go in and we start to understand what holds them in place. Like, how does this become a foundation for a way of life, and then how do we actually change it? In changing this, we first have to understand that one of the ways that it stays there, the core wound and the shame and the guilt, is because when we're exposed in an environment that is shaming and guilting heavily, it shuts down the way that we express ourselves. So we don't express ourselves fully and get to really know and understand who we really are so that we can build confidence and self-assurance in that person. We start really limiting the way that we express ourselves because there's so few ways that we actually feel safe in doing so. And even in the areas where we feel safe, we're pretty vulnerable. So we have this real issue where we can't be vulnerable in the world. We don't express authentically who we really are. And if it goes on for a long period of time, a person starts to really not know significant parts of who they really are because they're totally suppressed. So the idea is that we really take a look at, where are we holding shame? Where are we holding guilt? What is our core wound? Do we think we're not good enough, not lovable enough, not worthy? What is it really? And then we begin to reverse it. So in the reversing process of that, the idea is that we really come to terms with the shame, the guilt, the secrets that have been created in our life because of shame and guilt. You'll find that people that have shame and guilt usually have tremendous secrets in their life. Either they've done something, somebody's done something to them, they've been exposed to things that weren't good that were done, and those things are just eating away at them internally, and they have no way to express them because they're being held by shame and guilt. So they feel that they'll be rejected. They often have a fear of abandonment that goes along with it. If they were to expose whatever that is, that, you know, they would be in some kind of danger, or people would leave them, or they would lose everything that they have. And this is then, Brandon, it's reinforced in society. So we see this on the news. We see it in our political culture. We see it in our social culture. It's like if people do not conform or they step outside the box, and it's threatening to any specific group of people, it's like we use shame and guilt to try to shove them back in the box, right? Or we accuse them of things that they're not actually doing, but they're trying to express an opinion, and we accuse them of something that's completely different. That shaming and guilting and not allowing a person to even come out and start to express. So they just run back inside of themselves again. And when they do that, they start to become a shell of a person. Like they're just like a ghost. There's just nothing there. And their life is full of anxieties and insecurities and often, you know, physical illness, mental illness, dysfunction, very often substance abuse. So, you know, what's frightening about it is that the longer it goes on, the worse it gets. It doesn't get better unless you go in and actually do something about that. We have a program that we put people through that deals specifically with that called Date with Your Dark Side. But there's a lot of places that a person can go for help. They could go to therapy. They could go to a spiritual advisor. They could go to a counselor. They could work on it themselves. But the idea is that they got to get in there and they have to do some serious work on themselves to reverse that process so that they can develop a real solid identity that they're happy with in their life. They're self-aware. They know who they are. Other people can't rattle that on them. And then they can move through their life very productively and happy.
Yeah, and chances are you can't do that by yourself. That's what you're saying. You cannot do this alone. You're going to need somebody to help you. And I think that's what's so great about this diagram. And I think what we'll do is we'll link in the notes to just a diagram so you can see it. Out of context, I mean, it should be able to provide enough context with what David was just saying, but really looking at it and how this core wound is affected, you know, by the patterns that you created and the patterns that you grew up in your environment and all those sorts of things, but actually doing something about it, I think is really, really powerful. So I thank Adam for sending in that, you know, question around a little bit more understanding around core wound. And if you want a deeper dive into that, you can always come to one of David's events because chances are he will go through this because oftentimes we don't know how much shame and guilt really rules our lives until you start to learn about it through David's teaching. So that's perfect. Before we go, I did want to put a couple more plugs out there for a few episodes that do talk a little bit about the core wound and about all of these things that David answered in that last question. So if you go back and listen to episode 35, David talked about the J curve, which is that generational patterns that all of us have gone through in our lives that we get from our parents. So that's definitely one piece you want to go back to, episode 35. Also, just within the last couple of weeks, David did two sort of like partner episodes, episode 82, which we called the mother-father wounds. Definitely want to go back and check that out. That's very fresh in your feed, so you should be able to find that one. And then also episode 85, Transcending Childhood Stories. Both of those, listened together over and over, are going to provide you with all the context you need around this core wound and what you can do to start to drop that shame and guilt so you can be your better self. David, anything you want to send us off with before we head out for this episode?
Just go back and make a study of it. You know, like I just wanted to add to what you were saying about having somebody to go through this with, you need somebody that can give you some perspective. And it's very difficult to gain perspective when you're coming from a lot of pain. So it's like somebody can hold a light or another way of thinking about something in front of you where you can evaluate that in your mind and your emotions and then be able to start to step into it. So I just wanted to add to that. That's great, though. Great questions, everybody. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you all so much. And again, if you want to send us some feedback or send us questions, you know, David wants to make this a practice every, you know, every few episodes to be able to jump in, and you can ask David these questions and we'll get them here. You can either send them to tsm@davidnagel.com or send us a voicemail. We'd love to play you live on the show. Speakpipe.com/David Nagel. The more questions you give, the more brilliance we get to pull out of David. And that's really what we're here for. So, David, thanks so much for this and appreciate your time.
You got it. Thanks, T.
All right. We'll catch you on the next one. Later.
Listening to the Successful Mind podcast. And if you like what you heard and you want to know more, go to davidnagel.com/freestuff.